I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. The organizations NYC CAN and Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth have combined efforts to initiate the Building What campaign. NYC CAN is a group of family members who lost loved ones on 9/11 who are seeking a new investigation into the events of that day, due to the enormous amount of evidence that proves that the official government explanation of 9/11, which is also a conspiracy theory, could not possibly be true. The Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth have studied the scientific evidence of the collapses of the three World Trade Center towers, and their research shows that the official government reports on how the three towers came down are unscientific and false. They, too, are calling for a new investigation. The Building What campaign is essentially a campaign to increase awareness of the collapse of World Trade Center Building 7, which was not hit by a plane on 9/11. Building 7 is considered the smoking gun of 9/11. The Building What campaign began by running a 30-second TV ad in New York City in early November, with four of the family members discussing Building 7 and why they want a new investigation. The name of the campaign, Building What, comes from a judge in New York City who in 2009 was ruling on the New York City CAN's efforts to get a new investigation on the ballot for New York City residents to vote on. Building 7 was mentioned, and the judge said, Building What? He had never heard of that building coming down on 9/11. And it's no wonder. The corporate media stopped covering it shortly after 9/11, and the 9/11 Commission report doesn't discuss it at all. I think it's mentioned there in one footnote, and that's the only place in the whole entire report. A group of scientists examined a variety of dust samples from the World Trade Center towers and found that the dust contained red-gray chips. The scientists concluded, based on all their findings, that the red layer of the red-gray chips is active, unreacted thermitic material incorporating nanotechnology, and that it is a highly energetic, pyrotechnic, or explosive material. In April 2009, a team of scientists that included physicist Stephen Jones, formerly of Brigham Young University, chemist Niels Harrit of the University of Copenhagen in Denmark, physicist Jeffrey Fair of Brigham Young University, and six other authors published their findings regarding the red-gray chips in the peer-reviewed paper, Active Thermitic Material Discovered in Dust from the 9/11 World Trade Center Catastrophe. This was then published in the Open Chemical Physics Journal in 2009. And you can find that on the website ct911truth.org. So that's www.ct911truth.org. And you can read that article for yourself. Today you'll hear the second part of a discussion by Jeffrey Farrer, one of the authors of this peer-reviewed paper, discussing the findings in the red-gray chips. If you missed the first part last week, you can go to the website radioforall.net and go to Contributors and look for my name, Cheryl, and 9/11 Wake Up Call, and you can listen to part one there. The concluding part of Jeffrey Fair's discussion of the finding of explosive materials in the dust of the World Trade Center buildings is about 11 minutes long. And that's followed by an audio clip of a variety of first responders and reporters remarking on the quality of the debris from the collapse of the towers. So let's begin with Jeffrey Fair.
And they were striking in their similarity. The paper that we wrote about the red-gray chips, you can actually see, we've taken photographs of these red-gray chips to show these things are so similar, we couldn't ignore these red-gray chips any longer. And that's where the paper really took off. That's where the data for the paper really took off. Some have speculated that the red-gray chips are just paint. I haven't seen any studies of paint by those that are speculating this. We did our own study of paint in the DSC and found that the paint will eventually burn up and turn to ash, but it certainly doesn't give you an energetic spike in the DSC. So we actually did some experiments to compare the elemental composition of primer paint from the Trade Center steel that was taken off of one of the beams in the Clarkson College beams. But it was taken from one of the beams used in the World Trade Center. And the chemical composition did not match that of the red-gray chips. So we know that it's not the primer paint that was on the steel. So once the chips were ignited in the DSC, we then looked at the residue or the remnant of those chips in the microscope again. And we did find very, very small spheres that were similar to the microspheres that Steve was finding in the dust samples, smaller on average, but still very similar in composition and in look of the microspheres that Steve was finding. So one of the things that I'll just mention briefly about the paper that was written that compiled all of this data from the red-gray chips, the first thing that we wanted to do was to establish that all of the chips were similar. And when I say all of the chips collected from the different dust samples that were collected from different areas in Manhattan, from different individuals who are not associated. So once we collected different chips from the different samples, we then took photomicrographs as well as looking at them in the scanning electron microscope, and then compositional analysis of both the red layer and the gray layer. And all of these things showed that these red-gray chips are the same. The compositional analysis of the red layer was the same. The compositional analysis of the gray layer was the same. Their appearance and cleavage habit or microstructure appeared the same. All of those things appeared the same. Then we ran multiple samples through the DSC, the differential scanning calorimeter, and found that they behaved almost identical. The peak heights were very similar. The location of the peaks were exact. So once we were able to establish that these things were all the same, that's when we were able to then, with more confidence, try and determine what these things really were. So now what we have is the composition of the red layer. We have an aluminum peak, we have a silicon peak, we have the iron and the oxygen, as well as other peaks. And one of the things that we did to ensure that we weren't getting surface contamination was we just took some of these chips, which are very, very small, by the way, and under a microscope we were able to cleave these chips or break them in half and then study the fresh or the broken surface so that we weren't getting surface contamination. These things were coming in bags of dust, so who knows what kind of contamination you'd get on the surface. So we were looking at these broken or these clean edges in order to get the composition. And that's where we found the silicon as well as the aluminum peaks and the iron and oxygen peaks in abundance and throughout all of the red layers in all of these chips. The gray layer was also interesting. We found that was mostly iron and oxygen. And again, each gray layer was identical in its compositional analysis as well as its appearance. And then what we found from the DSC, there was actually some significant findings in the residue. After igniting these chips in the DSC, we found microspheres that were very shiny in appearance. Some of them were almost glassy, a little translucent. And we found that the composition of these microspheres, of these very small spheres, many of these spheres had the exact or identical composition or very similar composition as the spheres that Steve was finding in the dust samples. They were also very similar to spheres found in thermite, in commercial thermite. Once you ignite commercial thermite, you also get microspheres. And the composition was very, very similar. And that led to the conclusion of the paper, which was, we've got some form of thermite in these red-gray chips. And I think it's a very, very strong conclusion. There have been some that have argued that these red-gray chips could be paint of some form. We actually did a study on some epoxy paint. We put that in the DSC. We found that paint would just burn up and turn to ash. So you may get a minor exothermic peak, but it's nothing. It's not energetic. It's a very smooth, wide peak, and it's certainly not an energetic material. As part of the residue of the paint that we ignited in the DSC, the actual paint, it was basically ash. There were no microspheres found in the paint sample that had been ignited in the DSC. We also took paint that came off of the WTC steel and looked at that in the SEM and did a compositional analysis of that and found that it was not similar to the red-gray chip or the red layer of the red-gray chips. So it wasn't, the red-gray chips are not the primer paint that was used on the WTC steel. There are a lot of questions that came up during the paper that have been left unanswered or that are unanswered and need to be answered. Just an example, what is the gray layer? What was the purpose of the gray layer? We know it has a lot of iron, we know it has a lot of oxygen, and we've found that there's a hematite phase, but there are other phases present in that gray layer, and we don't know quite what that gray layer is or how it's adhered to the red layer. Certainly further study needs to be done. We certainly need to be doing more work to find out what that is. Occasionally we would find an intermediate layer between the red layer and the gray layer, which was rich in carbon, perhaps a polymer type layer. But again, we need to go further with that study to figure out what those things are. There are some characteristics of the red layer that are rather significant. One is that it's not homogeneous. There are different particles or grains within the red layer that we studied. One appeared very bright under backscattered electron microscopy, which indicates a heavier phase. And we looked into those small particles. They were rhombohedral in shape and very consistent throughout the layer. They were about 100 nanometers in size, roughly, and very consistent in both their size, the shape of them, and as well as the composition that we could get from the SEM. Additional studies in the TEM found that these were iron oxide phases. So these particles, these small bright particles, they appear bright in the SEM images in the paper. These were, in fact, iron oxide phases that we were able to pin down using the transmission electron microscope. There were other phases present as well, or other particles present in the red layer. There were some plate-like particles. Again, those were consistent throughout the red layer, throughout all of the samples that we found. And those appeared to have a higher aluminum and silicon peaks in their compositional analysis. And one of the significant things about what we find in the red layer is the fact that these particles that we find in the red layer, the fact that they're consistent, I mean consistent in shape and in composition and in size, leads me to believe that these things are not naturally occurring materials. The red layer is not a naturally occurring material. Sure, you have iron oxide everywhere. That you have iron, you get an iron oxide. But you don't get them in nice little 100 nanometer rhombohedral shaped particles inside of a red layer, a very small red layer. And by the way, these, just to give you a reference on the size, these particles that are in the red layer are thousands of times smaller than, say, the width of a human hair. So these are very sophisticated particles, very sophisticated materials, not materials that we would expect to find in the demolition debris of a building. In order to get that kind of consistency with shape and size and be that small, these really are sophisticated materials and probably only developed in a laboratory. They may be processed outside of a laboratory, but they're developed in a laboratory. There were several other things that were found that we put into the paper that I think are very significant, and the conclusion of the paper really does fit well with the data that we collected. Our conclusions were that the red-gray chips are some form of thermite or a nanothermite or an energetic material which is very similar to thermite. And that's a very strong conclusion given the data. Now others may say, well, could it be something else? Certainly. It certainly could be something else. I'm not about to say that we've completely ruled out everything, but the conclusions we made in the paper are very strong given the data. If there's another possibility, that's something that somebody can come forward with using the same very stringent scientific method that we used in this paper and publish that, and I can guarantee they will find that our work is completely reproducible. If you find other red-gray chips, they will look and have the same composition and the same behavior in the calorimeter as the red-gray chips that we found. Now, if they come up with different conclusions than we do, that's their prerogative, of course, and I'd like to see that. I'd like to see other people looking at these things, because that reproduces our results, and it also brings us to a discussion, which needs to happen. We need to be talking about this. There needs to be another investigation of the events of that day. And that's why I signed the petition at the A&E website, A&E for 9/11 Truth, Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. That's why I signed the petition, and I do believe there needs to be another investigation.
What the 9/11 Truth movement wants is a new and independent investigation with subpoena power into the events of 9/11. Since a majority of the 9/11 Commission Report commissioners and their chief legal counsel, John Farmer, have admitted, after the fact, that they were obstructed in their investigation and that we don't have the truth about 9/11, it would seem very reasonable and indeed necessary to have a real investigation with subpoena power. If you agree with this, you can sign on to the petition demanding a new one at ae911truth.org. Since you just heard physicist Jeffrey Fair discussing the scientific evidence of explosive materials found in the dust, I thought I'd follow that up with some of the uncensored observations and remarks by first responders and journalists on what they saw on 9/11. This comes from part one of a video put together by CTV911 from the World News Network and was posted on 9/11 Blogger on December 1st, 2010. I encourage you to watch the video of this online. The visuals are worth seeing. This is called 9/11 Debris, Investigation of Ground Zero, Part 1. So here goes.
The debris is just unbelievable.
That's the part that's crazy. It's just that's all that's left.
You don't find a desk. You don't find a chair. You don't find a telephone, a computer.
That's the part that's crazy. It's just that's all that's left.
Almost cleanly on themselves. Where did they go?
Everything was dust and metal.
The building collapsed to dust.
Early estimates were that it would take up to 2 years to clean up Ground Zero. But in fact, the process went much more quickly and was significantly under budget.
Architects, engineers, people who work with steel, welders have just never seen the level of destruction and the level of deformation of this material in our lives.
I found it hard to believe that it actually bent because of the size of it and how there's no cracks in the iron. It bent without almost a single crack in it.
Just everything is smashed to atoms. There are no big pieces of anything.
There were no desks. There were no phones. There were, you know, maybe now and then you find a fragment of something, but basically everything was just pulverized.
There wasn't a computer screen, a laptop. There was no office. I mean, it was, you know, 210-story buildings of office equipment. You know, it's just it's beyond comprehension.
It was like the surface of another planet. All there was powdered debris and metal. It was a very strange scene.
And just the debris fields, it's amazing. It's beyond anything I've ever seen like that. I've seen collapses and demolition buildings, but nothing like this was unbelievable. Like I said, there wasn't a door, there wasn't anything to be found. It was all disintegrated, all rubble. Concrete was small little pieces, not even slabs. No desk, no furniture, no computers, no phones, no anything. So I imagine so the people were the same as the building, nothing left.
Where did all that building material disappear to?
It disappeared into its own dust.
You were walking in dust maybe up to your ankles.
All the furnishings and the fixtures inside the building, none of that existed after the collapse. There were no desks, there were no phones, no computers, no copy machines, no chairs, nothing. That had all been pulverized by the tremendous amount of energy that was created by this collapse. And it was just pulverized into this dust.
And I started digging those first couple of buckets. I started to look at this dust, this powdered, and all I could think of is that that I was getting the feeling that there was people in this pulverized dust.
Where is everybody?
Yeah, it was. I mean, you didn't find a shard of glass, anything that looked like would be used by a person. You just didn't see. It was just concrete, steel. That was it, and dust.
Engineers at the firm that built the building's best guess to account for the missing 1,200 feet of material from each tower is that large portions simply vaporized into the dust that rained down on New Yorkers immediately after the collapse. It was that powerful.
Get out of here!
We're talking here about 43,600 windows, 600,000 square feet of glass, 200,000 tons of structural steel, 5 million square feet of gypsum, 6 acres of marble, and 425,000 cubic yards of concrete, turned in good part into a cloud, says environmental medical doctor Stephen Levin.
I was astonished at the degree to which solid materials were turned into pulverized dust as a consequence of that building collapse. I think it was striking.
The Environmental Protection Agency has been sampling the dust, and one specialist told ABC they believe the clouds that appeared immediately after the collapse were mostly gypsum dust from drywall, cement dust, and plaster, which can cause problems.
Cement dust is an irritant. Fine glass powder is also an irritating material.
The EPA did find spotty levels of asbestos. A sample on a police car turned out dangerous. Another sample a couple of blocks away, not dangerous. But most interesting in the mix, they are looking, they think, at specks of steel that used to be beams and elevators, marble from the lobby floor and facings. So what were once the strongest architectural elements in the two towers were pulverized, large portions turned into clouds.
People who have been right down next to the base of what was the Trade Towers say there's virtually nothing left, maybe a few flights of stairs, a few stories of one of the buildings, but that when they came down, there was so much melting and so much demolishing of any kind of structure that they cannot...
It's an interesting question when you saw those two giant towers collapse almost cleanly on themselves. Where did they go? I have read in some architecture article that they were made mostly of air. If you consider the space between the solid molecules, the steel, the concrete, the glass, the aluminum, there was a lot of air, was mostly air actually. Where did they go was part of the disbelief that I was feeling.
Oh my goodness me.
All that's standing of the Twin Towers right now in the background, that's all that's standing. That's it, that's all that's left.
So you were literally right inside. What time did you actually
take these photos? I don't even know. That was actually, I rode my motorcycle right up from there. That was like about, that was about an hour ago, not even.
And this is right at the center of where the Trade Towers stood.
You can see, like, when you see the firemen, there's nothing they can do. It's just like...
It's absolutely...
Look at that. That's all that's left.
Do you know whether that's the South Tower or the North Tower?
That's the South Tower.
And you saw no sign of life in here whatsoever?
See, that's the concourse below. That's going down like 20 feet or so. But that's the part that's crazy. It's just that's all that's left.
On the surface, firefighters and others continued to comb the debris for remains. Aside from huge pieces of twisted steel from the towers, there was little that was recognizable in the debris. Shrapnel-like fragments, gray dust. No one had ever seen anything like it, even at the site of the Murrow Building in Oklahoma City, also destroyed by an act of terrorism.
They said, you know, in Oklahoma City, you could see pieces of desks and chairs, and there was something that told you that this was an office building. At the World Trade Center site, it seems like everything was pulverized.
One of the more unusual artifacts to emerge from the rubble is this rock-like object that has come to be known as the meteorite.
This fused element of steel, molten steel and concrete and all of these things all fused by the heat into one single element.
And almost like a chunk of lava from Kilauea or Iceland, where they're very sharp but breakable shards on the end here.
By September 12th, the Freshkills landfill had been chosen as the site where small debris would be sorted. Freshkills, an enormous waste facility on Staten Island, sits across the New York Harbor from Ground Zero. New York City Police Deputy Inspector Jim Luongo and FBI agent Richard Marks have been in charge of the operation from the beginning. They've also led the effort to save personal property and artifacts for museums, hoping to keep these memories alive with future generations.
Is there one artifact that stands out for any particular reason for you?
I think the lack of artifacts stands out to me quite a bit. I think the fact that I haven't seen a door, I haven't seen a phone, I haven't seen a computer, I haven't seen a doorknob, I think that stands out. But for the things that we have seen, every now and then we'll come across a stuffed animal that might have been on somebody's desk, pictures that were on people's desks that we're trying to restore.
Perhaps the most astonishing object Shate found is something there should have been thousands of. This one probably only survived because it was in the basement. It belonged to an ice cream store.
I'd pretty much given up trying to find some sort of intact file cabinet. But while I was at the compound for the Port Authority police, this ball of metal about the size of a basketball was delivered to them. You can see what remains of the file folders that were inside.
In the beginning, there were people that wanted the name of the landfill changed. They thought it was a morbid thing. But a kill is Dutch for a river. And so the name was kept. First, when I saw it, I thought they were moving mounds of dirt around with loaders. And what we were seeing was the ground remains of the World Trade Center. And it had a very organized sense to it. The material came in these buckets all together and put in one place. And then it was sorted. We saw nothing we could recognize in the fields. We expected to see chairs and file cabinets and what was left of offices. Everything was reduced to the finest state. It basically looked like mountains of dirt. There were hills of gray dirt, vast expanses of wire, twisted rebar, fields of steel, and the fields of vehicles. The minute we got there and wouldn't let us take our pictures, we planned to figure out a way to get back there and take photographs.
And again, that was called 9/11 Debris, Investigation of Ground Zero, Part 1. And you can find that posted on 9/11 Blogger on December 1st, 2010. I just picked up a copy of the book Censored 2011, which details the top 25 censored stories of 2009-2010, edited by Mickey Huff and Peter Phillips of Project Censored. Here are a few of the top censored stories that they include in the book. Global plans to replace the dollar. Internet privacy and personal access at risk. ICE operates secret detention and courts. Blackwater, the secret U.S. war in Pakistan. Human rights abuses continue in Palestine. U.S. funds and supports the Taliban. The H1N1 swine flu pandemic, manipulating data to enrich drug companies. Obama cuts domestic spending and increases military corporate welfare. Increased tensions with unresolved 9/11 issues. Prisoners still brutalized at Gitmo. Massacre in Peruvian Amazon over U.S. free trade agreement. External capitalist forces wreak havoc in Africa. And those are just some of the stories. I encourage you to get a copy of the book and support Project Censored. And now I want to remind you that 9/11 Wake Up Call airs on Thursdays at 12:30 p.m. on WWUH 91.3 FM. And on Tuesdays at 2 p.m. on WESU 88.1 FM. And the shows are also archived on the website ct911truth.org. And my more recent shows are on radioforall.net. And that's the number for radioforall.net. And I want to thank Damon Bean for putting my shows on the CT911Truth website. And Ken Doust, who does the show at WWUH called New World Notes on Tuesdays at noon, for putting my shows up on radioforall.net. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.